general configuration of a good, organized, and just society. The oppressed are regarded as the pathology of the healthy society, which must therefore adjust these incompetent and lazy folk to its own patterns by changing their mentality. These marginals need to be integrated, incorporated into the healthy society that they have forsaken. The truth is, however, that the oppressed are not marginals, are not people living outside society. They have always been inside, inside the structure which made them beings for others. The solution is not to integrate them into the structure of oppression, but to transform that structure so that they can become beings for themselves. Such transformation, of course, would undermine the oppressor's purposes, hence their utilization of the banking concept of education to avoid the threat of student conscientization. The banking approach to adult education, for example, will never propose to students that they critically consider reality. It will deal instead with such vital questions as whether Roger gave green grass to the goat and insist on the importance of learning that, on the contrary, Roger gave green grass to the rabbit. The humanism of the banking approach masks the effort to turn women and men into automatons, the very negation of their ontological vocation to be more fully human. Those who use the banking approach knowingly or unknowingly, for there are innumerable well-intentioned bank clerk teachers who do not realize that they are serving only to dehumanize, fail to perceive that the deposits themselves contain contradictions about reality. But sooner or later, these contradictions may lead formerly passive students to turn against their domestication and the attempt to domesticate reality. They may discover through existential experience that their present way of life is irreconcilable with their vocation to become fully human. They may perceive through their relations with reality that reality is really a process undergoing constant transformation. If men and women are searchers and their ontological vocation is humanization, sooner or later they may perceive the contradiction in which banking education seeks to maintain them and then engage themselves in the struggle for their liberation. But the humanist revolutionary educator cannot wait for this possibility to materialize. From the outset, her efforts must coincide with those of the students to engage in critical thinking and the quest for mutual humanization. His efforts must be imbued with a profound trust in people and their creative power. To achieve this, they must be partners of the students in their relations with them. The banking concept does not admit to such partnership, and necessarily so. To resolve the teacher-student contradiction, to exchange the role of depositor, prescriber, domesticator, for the role of student among students would be to undermine the power of oppression and serve the cause of liberation. Implicit in the banking concept is the assumption of a dichotomy between human beings and the world. A person is merely in the world, not with the world or with others. The individual is spectator, not recreator. In this view, the person is not a conscious being, corpo consciente. He or she is rather the possessor of a consciousness, an empty mind passively open to the reception of deposits of reality from the world outside. For example, my desk, my books, my coffee cup, all the objects before me, as bits of the world which surround me, would be inside me, exactly as I am inside my study right now. This view makes no distinction between being accessible to consciousness and entering consciousness. The distinction, however, is essential. The objects which surround me are simply accessible to my consciousness, not located within it. I am aware of them, but they are not inside me. It follows logically from the banking notion of consciousness that the educator's role is to regulate the way the world enters into the students. The teacher's task is to organize a process which already occurs spontaneously, to fill the students by making deposits of information which he or she considers to constitute true knowledge. And since people receive the world as passive entities, education should make them more passive still and adapt them to the world. The educated individual is the adapted person, because she or he is better fit for the world. Translated into practice, this concept is well suited to the purposes of the oppressors, whose tranquility rests on how well people fit the world the oppressors have created, and how little they question it. The more completely the majority adapt to the purposes which the dominant minority prescribe for them, thereby depriving them of the right to their own purposes, the more easily the minority can continue to prescribe. The theory and practice of banking education serve this end quite efficiently. Verbalistic lessons, reading requirements, the methods for evaluating knowledge, the distance between the teacher and the taught, the criteria for promotion, everything in this ready-to-wear approach serves to obviate thinking. The bank clerk educator does not realize that there is no true security in his hypertrophied role, that one must seek to live with others in solidarity. One cannot impose oneself, nor even merely coexist with one's students. Solidarity requires true communication, and the concept by which such an educator is guided fears and proscribes communication. Yet only through communication can human life hold meaning. The teacher's thinking is authenticated only by the authenticity of the student's thinking. The teacher cannot think for her students, nor can she impose her thoughts on them. Authentic thinking, thinking that is concerned about reality, does not take place in ivory tower isolation, but only in communication. If it is true that thought has meaning only when generated by action upon the world, the subordination of students to teachers becomes impossible. Because banking education begins with a false understanding of men and women as objects, it cannot promote the development of what Fromm calls biophily, but instead produces its opposite, necrophily. When life is characterized by growth in a structured, functional manner, the necrophilous person loves all that does not grow, all that is mechanical. The necrophilous person is driven by the desire to transform the organic into the inorganic, to approach life mechanically as if all living persons were things, memory rather than experience, having rather than being is what counts. The necrophilous person can relate to an object, a flower, or a person only if he possesses it. Hence, a threat to his possession is a threat to himself. If he loses possession, he loses contact with the world. He loves control, and in the act of controlling, he kills life. Oppression, overwhelming control, is necrophilic. It is nourished by love of death, not life. The banking concept of education, which serves the interests of oppression, is also necrophilic. Based on a mechanistic, static, naturalistic, spatialized view of consciousness, it transforms students into receiving objects. It attempts to control thinking and action, leads women and men to adjust to the world, and inhibits their creative power. When their efforts to act responsibly are frustrated, when they find themselves unable to use their faculties, people suffer. This suffering due to impotence is rooted in the very fact that the human equilibrium has been disturbed. But the inability to act, which causes people's anguish, also causes them to reject their impotence by attempting to restore their capacity to act. But can they, and how? One way is to submit to and identify with a person or group having power. By this symbolic participation in another person's life, men have the illusion of acting, when in reality they only submit to and become a part of those who act. Populist manifestations perhaps best exemplify this type of behavior by the oppressed, who, by identifying with charismatic leaders, come to feel that they themselves are active and effective. The rebellion they express as they emerge in the historical process is motivated by that desire to act effectively. The dominant elites consider the remedy to be more domination and repression, carried out in the name of freedom, order, and social peace, that is, the peace of the elites. Thus they can condemn, logically from their point of view, the violence of a strike by workers, and can call upon the state in the same breath to use violence in putting down the strike. Education, as the exercise of domination, stimulates the credulity of students with the ideological intent, often not perceived by educators, of indoctrinating them to adapt to the world of oppression. This accusation is not made in the naive hope that the dominant elites will thereby simply abandon the practice. Its objective is to call the attention of true humanists to the fact that they cannot use banking educational methods in the pursuit of liberation, for they would only negate that very pursuit. Nor may a revolutionary society inherit these methods from an oppressor society. The revolutionary society which practices banking education is either misguided or mistrusting of people. In either event, it is threatened by the specter of reaction. Unfortunately, those who espouse the cause of liberation are themselves surrounded and influenced by the climate which generates the banking concept, and often do not perceive its true significance or its dehumanizing power. Paradoxically, then, they utilize the same instrument of alienation in what they consider an effort to liberate. Indeed, some revolutionaries brand as innocents, dreamers, or even reactionaries those who would challenge this educational practice. But one does not liberate people by alienating them. Authentic liberation, the process of humanization, is not another deposit to be made in men. Liberation is a praxis, the action and reflection of men and women upon their world in order to transform it. Those truly committed to the cause of liberation can accept neither the mechanistic concept of consciousness as an empty vessel to be filled, nor the use of banking methods of domination, propaganda, slogans, deposits, in the name of liberation. Those truly committed to liberation must reject the banking concept in its entirety, adopting instead a concept of women and men as conscious beings, and consciousness as consciousness intent upon the world. They must abandon the educational goal of deposit-making and replace it with a posing of the problems of human beings in their relations with the world. Problem-posing education, responding to the essence of consciousness, intentionality, rejects communiques and embodies communication. It epitomizes the special characteristic of consciousness, being conscious of, not only as intent on objects, but as turned in upon itself in a Jasperian split, consciousness as consciousness of consciousness. Liberating education consists in acts of cognition, not transferals of information. It is a learning situation in which the cognizable object, far from being the end of the cognitive act, intermediates the cognitive actors. Teacher on the one hand and students on the other. Accordingly, the practice of problem-posing education entails at the outset that the teacher-student contradiction to be resolved. Dialogical relations, indispensable to the capacity of cognitive actors to cooperate in perceiving the same cognizable object, are otherwise impossible. Indeed, problem-posing education, which breaks with the vertical patterns characteristic of banking education, can fulfill its function as the practice of freedom only if it can overcome the above contradiction. Through dialogue, the teacher of the students and the students of the teacher cease to exist as a new term emerges, teacher-student with students' teachers. The teacher is no longer merely the one who teaches, but one who is himself taught in dialogue with the students, who in turn, while being taught, also teach. They become jointly responsible for a process in which all grow. In this process, arguments based on authority are no longer valid. In order to function, authority must be on the side of freedom, not against it. Here, no one teaches another, nor is anyone self-taught. People teach each other, mediated by the world, by the cognizable objects which in banking education are owned by the teacher. The banking concept, with its tendency to dichotomize everything, distinguishes two stages in the action of the educator. During the first, he cognizes a cognizable object while he prepares his lessons in his study or his laboratory. During the second, he expounds to his students about that object. The students are not called upon to know, but to memorize the contents narrated by the teacher. Nor do the students practice any act of cognition, since the object towards which that act should be directed is the property of the teacher, rather than a medium evoking the critical reflection of both teacher and students. Hence, in the name of the preservation of culture and knowledge, we have a system which achieves neither true knowledge nor true culture. The problem-posing method does not dichotomize the activity of the teacher-student. She is not cognitive at one point and narrative at another. She is always cognitive, whether preparing a project or engaging in dialogue with the students. He does not regard cognizable objects as his private property, but as the object of reflection by himself and the students. In this way, the problem-posing educator constantly reforms his reflections in the reflection of the students. The students, no longer docile listeners, are now critical co-investigators in dialogue with the teacher. The teacher presents the material to the students for their consideration and reconsiders her earlier considerations as the students express their own. The role of the problem-posing educator is to create, together with the students, the conditions under which knowledge at the level of the doxa is superseded by true knowledge at the level of the logos. Whereas banking education anesthetizes and inhibits creative power, problem-posing education involves a constant unveiling of reality. The former attempts to maintain the submersion of consciousness. The latter strives for the emergence of consciousness and critical intervention in reality. Students, as they are increasingly posed with problems relating to themselves in the world and with the world, will feel increasingly challenged and obliged to respond to that challenge. Because they apprehend the challenge as interrelated to other problems within a total context, not as a theoretical question, the resulting comprehension tends to be increasingly critical and thus constantly less alienated. Their response to the challenge evokes new challenges, followed by new understandings, and gradually the students come to regard themselves as committed. Education as the practice of freedom, as opposed to education as the practice of domination, denies that man is abstract, isolated, independent, and unattached to the world. It also denies that the world exists as a reality apart from people. Authentic reflection considers neither abstract man nor the world without people, but people in their relations with the world. In these relations, consciousness and world are simultaneous. Consciousness neither precedes the world nor follows it. La conscience et l'amour sont donc de même coup. Extérieur par essence à la conscience, le monde est par essence relatif à elle. In one of our culture circles in Chile, the group was discussing, based on a codification, the anthropological concept of culture. In the midst of the discussion, a peasant who by banking standards was completely ignorant said, "Now I see that without man there is no world." When the educator responded, "Let's say for the sake of argument that all men on earth were to die, but that the earth itself remained, together with trees, birds, animals, rivers, seas, and stars, wouldn't all this be a world?" "Oh no," the peasant replied emphatically, "there would be no one to say, this is a world." The peasant wished to express the idea that they would be lacking the consciousness of the world, which necessarily implies the world of consciousness. "I cannot exist without a non-I. In turn, the not-I depends on that existence. The world which brings consciousness into existence becomes the world of that consciousness." Hence the previous cited affirmation of Sartre, "La conscience et le monde sont donc de même coup." As women and men, simultaneously reflecting on themselves and on the world, increase the scope of their perception, they begin to direct their observations towards previously inconspicuous phenomena. In perception properly so called, as an explicit awareness, gewahren, I am turned towards the object, to the paper, for instance. I apprehend it as being this here and now. The apprehension is a singling out, every object having a background in experience. Around and about the paper lie books, pencils, inkwell, and so forth. And these, in a certain sense, are also perceived perceptually there, in the field of intuition. But whilst I was turned towards the paper, there was no turning in their direction, nor any apprehending of them, not even in a secondary sense. They appeared and yet were not singled out, were not posited on their own account. Every perception of a thing has such a zone of background intuitions or background awareness, if intuiting already includes the state of being turned towards, and this also is a conscious experience, or more briefly, a consciousness of all indeed that in point of fact lies in the co-perceived objective background. That which has existed objectively, but had not been perceived in its deeper implications, if indeed it was perceived at all, begins to stand out, assuming the character of a problem and therefore of challenge. Thus men and women begin to single out elements from their background awareness and to reflect upon them. These elements are now objects of their consideration and, as such, objects of their action and cognition. In problem-posing education, people develop their power to perceive critically the way they exist in the world with which and in which they find themselves. They come to see the world not as a static reality, but as a reality in process, in transformation. Although the dialectical relations of women and men in the world exist independently of how these relations are perceived, or whether or not they are perceived at all, it is also true that the form of action they adopt is to a large extent a function of how they perceive themselves in the world. Hence the teacher-student and the student's teachers reflect simultaneously on themselves and the world without dichotomizing this reflection from action, and thus establish an authentic form of thought and action. Once again, the two educational concepts and practices under analysis come into conflict. Banking education, for obvious reasons, attempts by mythicizing reality to conceal certain facts which explain the way human beings exist in the world. Problem-posing education sets itself the task of demythologizing. Banking education resists dialogue. Problem-posing education regards dialogue as indispensable to the act of cognition which unveils reality. Banking education treats students as objects of assistance. Problem-posing education makes them critical thinkers. Banking education inhibits creativity and domesticates, although it cannot completely destroy, the intentionality of consciousness by isolating consciousness from the world, thereby denying people their ontological and historical vocation of becoming more fully human. Problem-posing education bases itself on creativity and stimulates true reflection and action upon reality, thereby responding to the vocation of persons as beings who are authentic only when engaged in inquiry and creative transformation. In sum, banking theory and practice, as immobilizing and fixating forces, fail to acknowledge men and women as historical beings. Problem-posing theory and practice take the people's historicity as their starting point. Problem-posing education affirms men and women as beings in the process of becoming, as unfinished, uncompleted beings in and with a likewise unfinished reality. Indeed, in contrast to other animals who are unfinished, but not historical, people know themselves to be unfinished. They are aware of their incompletion. In this incompletion and this awareness lie the very roots of education in an exclusively human manifestation. The unfinished character of human beings and the transformational character of reality necessitate that education be an ongoing activity. Education is thus constantly remade in the praxis. In order to be, it must become. Its duration, in the Bergsonian meaning of the word, is found in the interplay of the opposites, permanence and change. The banking method emphasizes permanence and becomes reactionary. Problem-posing education, which accepts neither a well-behaved present nor a predetermined future, roots itself in the dynamic present and becomes revolutionary. Problem-posing education is revolutionary futurity. Hence, it is prophetic and, as such, hopeful. Hence, it corresponds to the historical nature of humankind. Hence, it affirms women and men as beings who transcend themselves, who move forward and look ahead, for whom immobility presents a fatal threat, for whom looking at the past must only be a means of understanding more clearly what and who they are, so that they can more wisely build the future. Hence, it identifies with a movement which engages people as beings aware of their incompletion, an historical movement which has at its point of departure its subjects and its objective. The point of departure of the movement lies in the people themselves. But since people do not exist apart from the world, apart from reality, the movement must begin with a human-world relationship. Accordingly, the point of departure must always be with men and women in the here and now, which constitutes the situation within which they are submerged, from which they emerge, and in which they intervene. Only by starting from the situation which determines their perception of it can they begin to move. To do this authentically, they must perceive their state not as fated and unalterable, but merely as limiting and therefore challenging. Whereas the banking method directly or indirectly reinforces men's fatalistic perception of their situation, the problem-posing method presents this very situation to them as a problem. As the situation becomes the object of their cognition, the naive or magical perception which produced their fatalism gives way to perception which is able to perceive itself even as it perceives reality, and can thus be critically objective about that reality. A deepened consciousness of their situation leads people to apprehend that situation as an historical reality, susceptible of transformation. Resignation gives way to the drive for transformation and inquiry, over which men feel themselves to be in control. If people as historical beings necessarily engage with other people in a movement of inquiry, did not control that movement, it would be, and is, a violation of their humanity. Any situation in which some individuals prevent others from engaging in the process of inquiry is one of violence. The means used are not important. To alienate human beings from their own decision-making is to change them into objects. This movement of inquiry must be directed towards humanization, the people's historical vocation. The pursuit of full humanity, however, cannot be carried out in isolation or individualism, but only in fellowship and solidarity. Therefore, it cannot unfold in the antagonistic relations between oppressors and oppressed. No one can be authentically human while he prevents others from being so. Attempting to be more human individualistically leads to having more egotistically a form of dehumanization. Not that it is not fundamental to have in order to be human. Precisely because it is necessary, some men's having must not be allowed to constitute an obstacle to others' having, must not consolidate the power of the former to crush the latter. Problem-posing education as a humanist and liberating praxis posits as fundamental that the people subjected to domination must fight for their emancipation. To that end, it enables teachers and students to become subjects of the educational process by overcoming authoritarianism and an alienating intellectualism. It also enables people to overcome their false perception of reality. The world, no longer something to be described with deceptive words, becomes the object of that transforming action by men and women which results in their humanization. Problem-posing education does not and cannot serve the interests of the oppressor. No oppressive order could permit the oppressed to begin to question why. While only a revolutionary society can carry out this education in systematic terms, the revolutionary leaders need not take full power before they can employ the method. In the revolutionary process, The leaders cannot utilize the banking method as an interim measure, justified on grounds of expediency, with the intention of later behaving in a genuinely revolutionary fashion. They must be revolutionary, that is to say, dialogical, from the outset. Chapter 3. As we attempt to analyze dialogue as a human phenomenon, we discover something which is the essence of dialogue itself, the word. But the word is more than just an instrument which makes dialogue possible. Accordingly, we must seek its constitutive elements. Within the word we find two dimensions, reflection and action, in such radical interaction that if one is sacrificed, even in part, the other immediately suffers. There is no true word that is not at the same time a praxis. Thus, to speak a true word is to transform the world. An unauthentic word, one which is unable to transform reality, results when dichotomy is imposed upon its constitutive elements. When a word is deprived of its dimension of action, reflection automatically suffers as well. The word is changed into idle chatter, into verbalism, into an alienated and alienating blah. It becomes an empty word, one which cannot denounce the world, for denunciation is impossible without a commitment to transform, and there is no transformation without action. On the other hand, if action is emphasized exclusively to the detriment of reflection, the word is converted into activism. The latter, action for action's sake, negates the true praxis and makes dialogue impossible. Either dichotomy, by creating unauthentic forms of existence, creates also unauthentic forms of thought, which reinforce the original dichotomy. Human existence cannot be silent, nor can it be nourished by false words, but only by true words, with which men and women transform the world. To exist humanly is to name the world, to change it. Once named, the world in its turn reappears to the namers as a problem and requires of them a new naming. Human beings are not built in silence, but in word, in work, in action, reflection. But while to say the true word, which is work, which is praxis, is to transform the world, saying that word is not the privilege of some few persons, but the right of everyone. Consequently, no one can say a true word alone, nor can she say it for another in a prescriptive act which robs others of their words. Dialogue is the encounter between men mediated by the world in order to name the world. Hence, dialogue cannot occur between those who want to name the world and those who do not wish this naming, between those who deny others the right to speak their word and those whose right to speak has been denied them. Those who have been denied their primordial right to speak their word must first reclaim this right and prevent the continuation of this dehumanizing aggression. If it is in speaking their word that people, by naming the world, transform it, dialogue imposes itself as the way by which they achieve significance as human beings. Dialogue is thus an existential necessity. And since dialogue is the encounter in which the united reflection and action of the dialoguers are addressed to the world, which is to be transformed and humanized, this dialogue cannot be reduced to the act of one person's depositing ideas in another, nor can it become a simple exchange of ideas to be consumed by the discussants. Nor yet is it a hostile, polemical argument between those who are committed neither to the naming of the world nor to the search for truth, but rather to the imposition of their own truth. Because dialogue is an encounter among women and men who name the world, it must not be a situation where some name on behalf of others. It is an act of creation. It must not serve as a crafty instrument for the domination of one person by another. The domination implicit in dialogue is that of the world by the dialoguers. It is conquest of the world for the liberation of humankind. Dialogue cannot exist, however, in the absence of a profound love for the world and for people. The naming of the world, which is an act of creation and recreation, is not possible if it is not infused with love. Love is at the same time the foundation of dialogue and dialogue itself. It is thus necessarily the task of responsible subjects and cannot exist in a relation of domination. Domination reveals the pathology of love, sadism in the dominator and masochism in the dominated. Because love is an act of courage, not of fear, love is commitment to others. No matter where the oppressed are found, the act of love is a commitment to their cause, the cause of liberation. And this commitment, because it is loving, is dialogical. As an act of bravery, love cannot be sentimental. As an act of freedom, it must not serve as a pretext for manipulation. It must generate other acts of freedom, otherwise it is not love. Only by abolishing the situation of oppression is it possible to restore the love which that situation made impossible. If I do not love the world, if I do not love life, if I do not love people, I cannot enter into dialogue. On the other hand, dialogue cannot exist without humility. The naming of the world through which people constantly recreate that world cannot be an act of arrogance. Dialogue, as an encounter of those addressed to the common task of learning and acting, is broken if the parties, or one of them, lack humility. How can I dialogue if I always project ignorance onto others and never perceive my own? How can I dialogue if I regard myself as a case apart from others, mere its in whom I cannot recognize other eyes? How can I dialogue if I consider myself a member of an in-group of pure men, the owners of truth and knowledge, for whom all non-members are these people or the great unwashed? How can I dialogue if I start from the premise that naming the world is the task of an elite and that the presence of the people in history is a sign of deterioration, thus to be avoided? How can I dialogue if I am close to and even offended by the contribution of others? How can I dialogue if I am afraid of being displaced, the mere possibility causing me torment and weakness? Self-sufficiency is incompatible with dialogue. Men and women who lack humility or have lost it cannot come to the people, cannot be their partners in naming the world. Someone who cannot acknowledge himself to be as mortal as everyone else still has a long way to go before he can reach the point of encounter. At the point of encounter, they are neither utter ignoramuses nor perfect sages. They are only people who are attempting together to learn more than they now know. Dialogue further requires an intense faith in humankind, faith in their power to make and remake, to create and recreate, faith in their vocation to be more fully human, which is not the privilege of an elite, but the birthright of all. Faith in people is an a priori requirement for dialogue. The dialogical man believes in others even before he meets them face to face. His faith, however, is not naive. The dialogical man is critical and knows that although it is within the power of humans to create and transform, in a concrete situation of alienation, individuals may be impaired in the use of that power. Far from destroying his faith in the people, however, this possibility strikes him as a challenge to which he must respond. He is convinced that the power to create and transform, even when thwarted in concrete situations, tends to be reborn. And that rebirth can occur not gratuitously, but in and through the struggle for liberation, in the supersedence of slave labor by emancipated labor which gives zest to life. Without this faith in people, dialogue is a farce which inevitably degenerates into paternalistic manipulation. Founding itself upon love, humility, and faith, dialogue becomes a horizontal relationship of which mutual trust between the dialoguers is the logical consequence. It would be a contradiction in terms if dialogue, loving, humble, and full of faith, did not produce this climate of mutual trust which leads the dialoguers into ever closer partnership in the naming of the world. Conversely, such trust is obviously absent in the anti-dialogics of the banking method of education. Whereas faith in humankind is an a priori requirement for dialogue, trust is established by dialogue. Should it founder, it will be seen that the preconditions were lacking. False love, false humility, and feeble faith in others cannot create trust. Trust is contingent on the evidence which one party provides the others of his true, concrete intentions. It cannot exist if that party's words do not coincide with their actions. To say one thing and do another, to take one's own word lightly, cannot inspire trust. To glorify democracy and to silence the people is a farce. To discourse on humanism and to negate people is a lie. Nor yet can dialogue exist without hope. Hope is rooted in men's incompletion, from which they move out in constant search, a search which can be carried out only in communion with others. Hopelessness is a form of silence, of denying the world and fleeing from it. The dehumanizing resulting from an unjust order is not a cause for despair but for hope, leading to the incessant pursuit of the humanity denied by injustice. Hope, however, does not consist in crossing one's arms and waiting. As long as I fight, I am moved by hope, and if I fight with hope, then I can wait. As the encounter of women and men seeking to be more fully human, dialogue cannot be carried on in a climate of hopelessness. If the dialoguers expect nothing to come of their efforts, their encounter will be empty and sterile, bureaucratic and tedious. Finally, true dialogue cannot exist unless the dialoguers engage in critical thinking, thinking which discerns an indivisible solidarity between the world and the people and admits of no dichotomy between them, thinking which perceives reality as process, as transformation, rather than as a static entity, thinking which does not separate itself from action, but constantly immerses itself in temporality without fear of the risks involved. Critical thinking contrasts with naive thinking, which sees historical time as a weight, a stratification of the acquisitions and experiences of the past, from which the present should emerge normalized and well-behaved. For the naive thinker, the important thing is accommodation to this normalized today. For the critic, the important thing is the continuing transformation of reality in behalf of the continuing humanization of men. In the words of Pierre Furter, the goal will no longer be to eliminate the risks of temporality by clutching to guaranteed space, but rather to temporalize space. The universe is revealed to me not as space imposing a massive presence to which I can but adapt, but as a scope, a domain which takes shape as I act upon it. For naive thinking, the goal is precisely to hold fast to this guaranteed space and to adjust to it. By thus denying temporality, it denies itself as well. Only dialogue which requires critical thinking is also capable of generating critical thinking. Without dialogue, there is no communication, and without communication, there can be no true education. Education which is able to resolve the contradiction between teacher and student takes place in a situation in which both address their act of cognition to the object by which they are mediated. Thus, the dialogical character of education as the practice of freedom does not begin when the teacher's student meets with the student's teachers in a pedagogical situation, but rather when the former first asks herself or himself what she or he will dialogue with the latter about. The preoccupation with the content of dialogue is really preoccupation with the program content of education. For the anti-dialogical banking educator, the question of content simply concerns the program about which he will discourse to his students, and he answers his own question by organizing his own program. For the dialogical problem-posing teacher-student, the program content of education is neither a gift nor an imposition, bits of information to be deposited in the students, but rather the organized, systematized, and developed representation to individuals of the things about which they want to know more. Authentic education is not carried on by A for B or by A about B, but rather by A with B, mediated by the world, a world which impresses and challenges both parties, giving rise to views or opinions about it. These views, impregnated with anxieties, doubts, hopes, or hopelessness, imply significant themes on the basis of which the program content of education can be built. In its desire to create an ideal model of the good man, a naively conceived humanism often overlooks the concrete, existential, present situation of real people. Authentic humanism, in Pierre Furter's words, consists in permitting the emergence of the awareness of our full humanity as a condition and as an obligation, as a situation and as a project. We simply cannot go to the laborers, urban or peasant, in the banking style, to give them knowledge or to impose upon them the model of the good man contained in a program whose content we have ourselves organized. Many political and educational plans have failed because their authors designed them according to their own personal views of reality, never once taking into account, except as mere objects of their actions, the men in a situation to whom their program was ostensibly directed. For the truly humanist educator and the authentic revolutionary, the object of action is the reality to be transformed by them together with other people, not other men and women themselves. The oppressors are the ones who act upon the people to indoctrinate them and adjust them to a reality which must remain untouched. Unfortunately, however, in their desire to obtain the support of the people for revolutionary action, revolutionary leaders often fall for the banking line of planning program content from the top down. They approach the peasant or urban masses with projects which may correspond to their own view of the world, but not to that of the people. They forget that their fundamental objective is to fight alongside the people for the recovery of the people's stolen humanity, not to win the people over to their side. Such a phrase does not belong in the vocabulary of revolutionary leaders, but in that of the oppressor. The revolutionary's role is to liberate and be liberated with the people, not to win them over. In their political activity, the dominant elites utilize the banking concept to encourage passivity in the oppressed, corresponding with the latter's submerged state of consciousness, and take advantage of that passivity to fill that consciousness with slogans which create even more fear of freedom. This practice is incompatible with a truly liberating cause of action, which, by presenting the oppressor's slogans as a problem, helps the oppressed to eject those slogans from within themselves. After all, the task of the humanists is surely not that of pitting their slogans against the slogans of the oppressors, with the oppressed as the testing ground, housing the slogans of first one group and then the other. On the contrary, the task of the humanists is to see that the oppressed become aware of the fact that as dual beings, housing the oppressors within themselves, they cannot be truly human. This task implies that revolutionary leaders do not go to the people in order to bring them a message of salvation, but in order to come to know through dialogue with them both their objective situation and their awareness of that situation, the various levels of perception of themselves and of the world in which and with which they exist. One cannot expect positive results from an educational or political action program which fails to respect the particular view of the world held by the people. Such a program constitutes cultural invasion, good intentions notwithstanding. The starting point for organizing the program content of educational political action must be the present existential concrete situation reflecting the aspirations of the people. Utilizing certain basic contradictions, we must pose this existential, concrete, present situation to the people as a problem which challenges them and requires a response, not just at the intellectual level, but at the level of action. We must never merely discourse on the present situation, must never provide the people with programs which have little or nothing to do with their own preoccupations, doubts, hopes, and fears. Programs which at times, in fact, increase the fears of the oppressed consciousness. It is not our role to speak to the people about our own view of the world, nor to attempt to impose that view on them, but rather to dialogue with the people about their view and ours. We must realize that their view of the world manifested variously in their actions reflects their situation in the world. Educational and political action, which is not critically aware of this situation, runs the risk either of banking or of preaching in the desert. Often educators and politicians speak and are not understood because their language is not attuned to the concrete situation of the people they address. Accordingly, their talk is just alienated and alienating rhetoric. The language of the educator or the politician, it seems more and more clear that the latter must also become an educator in the broadest sense of the word, like the language of the people cannot exist without thought, and neither language nor thought can exist without a structure to which they refer. In order to communicate effectively, educator and politician must understand the structural conditions in which the thought and language of the people are dialectically framed. It is to the reality which mediates men and to the perception of that reality held by educators and people that we must go to find the program content of education. The investigation of what I have termed the people's thematic universe, the complex of their generative themes, inaugurates the dialogue of education as the practice of freedom. The methodology of that investigation must likewise be dialogical, affording the opportunity both to discover generative themes and to stimulate people's awareness in regard to these themes. Consistent with the liberating purpose of dialogical education, the object of the investigation is not persons, as if they were anatomical fragments, but rather the thought language with which men and women refer to reality, the levels at which they perceive that reality, and their view of the world in which their generative themes are found. Before describing a generative theme more precisely, which will also clarify what is meant by a minimum thematic universe, it seems to me indispensable to present a few preliminary reflections. The concept of a generative theme is neither an arbitrary invention nor a working hypothesis to be proved. If it were a hypothesis to be proved, the initial investigation would seek not to ascertain the nature of the theme, but rather the very existence or non-existence of themes themselves. In that event, before attempting to understand the theme in its richness, its significance, its plurality, its transformations, and its historical composition, we would first have to verify whether or not it is an objective fact. Only then could we proceed to apprehend it. Although an attitude of critical doubt is legitimate, it does appear possible to verify the reality of the generative theme not only through one's own existential experience, but also through critical reflection on the human-world relationship and on the relationships between people implicit in the former. This point deserves more attention. One may well remember, trite as it seems, that of the uncompleted beings, man is the only one to treat not only his actions, but his very self as the object of his reflection. This capacity distinguishes him from the animals, which are unable to separate themselves from their activity, and thus are unable to reflect upon it. In this apparently superficial distinction lie the boundaries which delimit the action of each in his life space. Because the animal's activity is an extension of themselves, the results of that activity are also inseparable from themselves. Animals can neither set objectives nor infuse their transformation of nature with any significance beyond itself. Moreover, the decision to perform this activity belongs not to them, but to their species. The animals are, accordingly, fundamentally beings in themselves. Unable to decide for themselves, unable to objectify either themselves or their activity, lacking objectives which they themselves have set, living submerged in a world to which they can give no meaning, lacking a tomorrow and a today because they exist in an overwhelming present, animals are ahistorical. Their ahistorical life does not occur in the world taken in its strict meaning. For the animal, the world does not constitute a not-I, which could set him apart as an I. The human world, which is historical, serves as a mere prop for the being in itself. Animals are not challenged by the configuration which confronts them. They are merely stimulated. Their life is not one of risk-taking, for they are not aware of taking risks. Risks are not challenges perceived upon reflection, but merely noted by the signs which indicate them. They accordingly do not require decision-making responses. Consequently, animals cannot commit themselves. Their ahistorical condition does not permit them to take on life. Because they do not take it on, they cannot construct it, and if they do not construct it, they cannot transform its configuration. Nor can they know themselves to be destroyed by life, for they cannot expand their prop world into a meaningful symbolic world which includes culture and history. As a result, animals do not animalize their configuration in order to animalize themselves, nor do they de-animalize themselves. Even in the forest, they remain beings in themselves, as animal-like there as in the zoo. In contrast, the people, aware of their activity and the world in which they are situated, acting in function of the objectives which they propose, having the seat of their decisions located in themselves and in their relations with the world and with others, infusing the world with their creative presence by means of the transformation they effect upon it, unlike animals, not only live but exist, and their existence is historical. Animals live out their lives on an atemporal, flat, uniform prop. Humans exist in a world which they are constantly recreating and transforming. For animals, here is only a habitat with which they enter into contact. For people, here signifies not merely a physical space, but also an historical space. Strictly speaking, here, now, there, tomorrow, and yesterday do not exist for the animal whose life lacking self-consciousness is totally determined. Animals cannot surmount the limits imposed by the here and the now or the there. Humans, however, because they are aware of themselves and thus of the world, because they are conscious beings, exist in a dialectical relationship between the determination of limits and their own freedom. As they separate themselves from the world which they objectify, as they separate themselves from their own activity, as they locate the seat of their decisions in themselves and in their relations with the world and others, people overcome the situations which limit them. The limit situations. Once perceived by individuals as fetters, as obstacles to their liberation, these situations stand out in relief from the background, revealing their true nature as concrete historical dimensions of a given reality. Men and women respond to the challenge with actions which Vieira Pinto calls limit acts, those directed at negating and overcoming rather than passively accepting the given. Thus, it is not the limit situations in and of themselves which create a climate of hopelessness, but rather how they are perceived by women and men at a given historical moment, whether they appear as fetters or as insurmountable barriers. As critical perception is embodied in action, a climate of hope and confidence develops, which leads men to attempt to overcome the limit situations. This objective can be achieved only through action upon the concrete historical reality in which limit situations historically are found. As reality is transformed and these situations are superseded, new ones will appear, which in turn will evoke new limit acts. The prop world of animals contains no limit situations due to its ahistorical character. Similarly, animals lack the ability to exercise limit acts, which require a decisive attitude towards the world, separation from and objectification of the world in order to transform it. Organically bound to their prop, animals do not distinguish between themselves and the world. Accordingly, animals are not limited by limit situations, which are historical, but rather by the entire prop. And the appropriate role for animals is not to relate to their prop, in that event the prop would be a world, but to adapt to it. Thus, when animals produce a nest, a hive, or a burrow, They are not creating products which result from limit acts, that is, transforming responses. Their productive activity is subordinated to the satisfaction of a physical necessity, which is simply stimulating rather than challenging. An animal's product belongs immediately to its physical body, whilst man freely confronts his product. Only products which result from the activity of a being but do not belong to its physical body, though these products may bear its seal, can give a dimension of meaning to the context, which thus becomes a world. A being capable of such production, who thereby is necessarily aware of himself, is a being for himself, could no longer be if she or he were not in the process of being in the world with which he or she relates, just as the world would no longer exist if this being did not exist. The difference between animals who, because their activity does not constitute limit acts, cannot create products detached from themselves, and humankind, who through their action upon the world create the realm of culture and history, is that only the latter are beings of the praxis. Only human beings are praxis, the praxis which, as the reflection and action which truly transform reality, is the source of knowledge and creation. Animal activity which occurs without a praxis is not creative. People's transforming activity is. It is as transforming and creative beings that humans, in their permanent relations with reality, produce not only material goods, tangible objects, but also social institutions, ideas, and concepts. Through their continuing praxis, men and women simultaneously create history and become historical social beings. Because, in contrast to animals, people can tridimensionalize time into the past, the present, and the future, their history, in function of their own creations, develops as a constant process of transformation within which epochal units materialize. These epochal units are not closed periods of time, static compartments within which people are confined. Were this the case, a fundamental condition of history, its continuity, would disappear. On the contrary, epochal units interrelate in the dynamics of historical continuity. An epoch is characterized by a complex of ideas, concepts, hopes, doubts, values, and challenges in dialectical interaction with their opposites, striving toward plenitude. The concrete representation of many of these ideas, values, concepts, and hopes, as well as the obstacles which impede the people's full humanization, constitute the themes of that epoch. These themes imply others which are opposing or even antithetical. They also indicate tasks to be carried out and fulfilled. Thus, historical themes are never isolated, independent, disconnected, or static. They are always interacting dialectically with their opposites. Nor can these themes be found anywhere except in the human-world relationship. The complex of interacting themes of an epoch constitutes its thematic universe. Confronted by this universe of themes in dialectical contradiction, persons take equally contradictory positions. Some work to maintain the structures, others to change them. As antagonism deepens between themes which are the expression of reality, there is a tendency for the themes and for reality itself to be mythicized, establishing a climate of irrationality and sectarianism. This climate threatens to drain the themes of their deeper significance and to deprive them of their characteristically dynamic aspect. In such a situation, myth-creating irrationality itself becomes a fundamental theme. Its opposing theme, the critical dynamic view of the world, strives to unveil reality, unmask its mythicization, and achieve a full realization of the human task, the permanent transformation of reality in favor of the liberation of people. In the last analysis, the themes both contain and are contained in limit situations. The tasks they imply require limit acts. When the themes are concealed by the limit situations and thus are not clearly perceived, the corresponding tasks, people's responses in the form of historical action, can be neither authentically nor critically fulfilled. In the situation, humans are unable to transcend the limit situations to discover that beyond these situations, and in contradiction to them, lies an untested feasibility. In sum, limit situations imply the existence of persons who are directly or indirectly served by these situations, and of those who are negated and curbed by them. Once the latter come to perceive these situations as the frontier between being and being more human, rather than the frontier between being and nothingness, they begin to direct their increasingly critical actions towards achieving the untested feasibility implicit in that perception. On the other hand, those who are served by the present limit situation regard the untested feasibility as a threatening limit situation which must not be allowed to materialize and act to maintain the status quo. Consequently, liberating actions upon an historical milieu must correspond not only to the generative themes, but to the way in which these themes are perceived. This requirement, in turn, implies another, the investigation of meaningful thematics. Generative themes can be located in concentric circles, moving from the general to the particular. The broadest epochal unit, which includes a diversified range of units and subunits, continental, regional, national, and so forth, contains themes of a universal character. I consider the fundamental theme of our epoch to be that of domination, which implies its opposite, the theme of liberation, as the objective to be achieved. It is this tormenting theme which gives our epoch the anthropological character mentioned earlier. In order to achieve humanization, which presupposes the elimination of dehumanizing oppression, it is absolutely necessary to surmount the limit situations in which people are reduced to things. Within the smaller circles, we find themes and limit situations characteristic of societies on the same continent or on different continents, which through these themes and limit situations share historical similarities. For example, underdevelopment, which cannot be understood apart from the relationship of dependency, represents a limit situation characteristic of societies of the Third World. The task implied by this limit situation is to overcome the contradictory relation of these object societies to the metropolitan societies. This task constitutes the untested feasibility for the Third World. Any given society within the broader epochal unit contains, in addition to the universal, continental, or historical similar themes, its own particular themes, its own limit situations. Within yet smaller circles, thematic diversifications can be found within the same society, divided into areas and sub-areas, all of which are related to the societal whole. These constitute epochal subunits. For example, within the same national unit, one can find the contradiction of the coexistence of the non-contemporaneous. Within these subunits, national themes may or may not be perceived in their true significance. They may simply be felt, sometimes not even that. But the non-existence of themes within the subunits is absolutely impossible. The fact that individuals in a certain area do not perceive a generative theme or perceive it in a distorted way may only reveal a limit situation of oppression in which people are still submerged. In general, a dominated consciousness, which has not yet perceived a limit situation in its totality, apprehends only its epiphenomena and transfers to the latter the inhibiting force which is the property of the limit situation. The fact is of great importance for the investigation of generative themes. When people lack a critical understanding of their reality, apprehending it in fragments which they do not perceive as interacting constituent elements of the whole, they cannot truly know that reality. To truly know it, they would have to reverse their starting point. They would need to have a total vision of the context in order subsequently to separate and isolate its constituent elements, and by means of this analysis, achieve a clearer perception of the whole. Equally appropriate for the methodology of thematic investigation and for problem-posing education is this effort to present significant dimensions of an individual's contextual reality, the analysis of which will make it possible for him to recognize the interaction of the various components. Meanwhile, the significant dimensions, which in their turn are constituted of parts of an interaction, should be perceived as dimensions of total reality. In this way, a critical analysis of a significant existential dimension makes possible a new critical attitude toward the limit situations. The perception and comprehension of reality are rectified and acquire new depth. When carried out with the methodology of Conscientisation, the investigation of the generative theme contained in the minimum thematic universe, the generative themes in interaction, thus introduces or begins to introduce women and men to a critical form of thinking about their world. In the event, however, that human beings perceive reality as dense, impenetrable, and enveloping, it is indispensable to proceed with the investigation by means of abstraction. This method does not involve reducing the concrete to the abstract, which would signify the negation of its dialectical nature, but rather maintaining both elements as opposites, which interrelate dialectically in the act of reflection. This dialectical movement of thought is exemplified perfectly in the analysis of a concrete existential coded situation. Its decoding requires moving from the abstract to the concrete. This requires moving from the part to the whole, and then returning to the parts. This in turn requires that the subject recognize himself in the object, the coded concrete existential situation, and recognize the object as a situation in which he finds himself together with other subjects. If the decoding is well done, this movement of flux and reflux from the abstract to the concrete, which occurs in the analysis of a coded situation, leads to the supersedence of abstraction by the critical perception of the concrete, which has already ceased to be a dense, impenetrable reality. When an individual is presented with a coded existential situation, a sketch or a photograph which leads by abstraction to the concreteness of existential reality, his tendency is to split that coded situation. In the process of decoding, this separation corresponds to the stage we call the description of the situation, and facilitates the discovery of the interaction among the parts of the disjointed whole. This whole, the coded situation, which previously had only been diffusely apprehended, begins to acquire meaning as thought flows back to it from the various dimensions. Since, however, the coding is the representation of an existential situation, the decoder tends to take the step from the representation to the very concrete situation in which and with which she finds herself. It is thus possible to explain conceptually why individuals begin to behave differently with regard to objective reality, once that reality has ceased to look like a blind alley and has taken on its true aspect, a challenge which human beings must meet. In all stages of decoding, people exteriorize their view of the world, and in the way they think about and face the world, fatalistically, dynamically, or statically, their generative themes may be found. A group which does not concretely express a generative thematics, a fact which might appear to imply the non-existence of themes, is, on the contrary, suggesting a very dramatic theme, the theme of silence. The theme of silence suggests a structure of mutism in face of the overwhelming force of the limit situations. I must re-emphasize that the generative theme cannot be found in people divorced from reality, nor yet in reality divorced from people, much less in no man's land. It can only be apprehended in the human-world relationship. To investigate the generative theme is to investigate people's thinking about reality and people's action upon reality, which is their praxis. For precisely this reason, the methodology proposed requires that the investigators and the people who would normally be considered objects of that investigation should act as co-investigators. The more active an attitude men and women take in regard to the exploration of their thematics, the more they deepen their critical awareness of reality and, in spelling out those thematics, take possession of that reality. Some may think it inadvisable to include the people as investigators in the search for their own meaningful thematics, that their intrusive influence, NB, the intrusion of those who are most interested or ought to be in their own education, will adulterate the findings and thereby sacrifice the objectivity of the investigation. This view mistakenly presupposes that themes exist in their original objective purity outside people, as if themes were things. Actually, themes exist in people in their relations with the world, with reference to concrete facts. The same objective fact could evoke different complexes of generative themes in different epochal subunits. There is, therefore, a relation between the given objective fact, the perception women and men have of this fact, and the generative themes. A meaningful thematics is expressed by people, and a given moment of expression will differ from an earlier moment if they have changed their perception of the objective facts to which the themes refer. From the investigator's point of view, the important thing is to detect the starting point at which the people visualize the given and to verify whether or not during the process of investigation any transformation has occurred in their way of perceiving reality. Objective reality, of course, remains unchanged. If the perception of that reality changes in the course of the investigation, that fact does not impair the validity of the investigation. We must realize that the aspirations, the motives, and the objectives implicit in the meaningful thematics are human aspirations, motives, and objectives. They do not exist out there somewhere as static entities. They are occurring. They are as historical as human beings themselves. Consequently, they cannot be apprehended apart from them. To apprehend these themes and to understand them is to understand both the people who embody them and the reality to which they